Hello and welcome to the DebtWire podcast. I am your host, Madalina Jakob, Managing Editor of DebtWire North America. Today, I am glad to be joined by Jennifer Daly, Head of Private Credit and Special Situations at Paul Hastings. She is Lead Counsel for Private Credit Funds, Special Situation and Opportunistic Funds, and has assisted borrowers in LBOs, Leverage Finance, Unitranche, Mezzanine, and Liability Management transactions. Some of Jennifer's significant clients include Blackstone, KKR, BDT and MSD Capital, Soundpoint Capital, and Antares. Jennifer was also ranked Band 1 for Private Credit by Chambers USA. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've always wanted to do a podcast, and I'm a huge fan of this one, so this is really such a treat, and I'm happy to represent our firm.
Great, let's dive in. This has been deemed by some as the golden age of private credit. And you, Jennifer, as the head of private credit and special situations at Paul Hastings, are right in the midst of this fast-growing market. What are some trends that you see in the market, especially now with a new administration about to take the helm in Washington?
So look, I think regardless of personal ideology, I think investment professionals across the political spectrum would all agree that the new administration is likely going to create a very deal-friendly environment, right? When you couple some of the cabinet appointments that we're looking at with knowledge of what the first Trump administration looked like and the impact that that will have on regulation and specifically deregulation, I don't think that it's a particularly brave prediction to say that, you know, we think there's going to be an uptick in M&A activity. But one of the things that I'm really fortunate to have at my firm is, you know, I sort of sit between a best-in-class finance practice and one that's best-in-class in restructuring. So we really actually look at this through a really broad lens. And what we see is just a really vast opportunity set. You know, when we talk about being in the midst of this exciting asset class, in some ways, we're in the midst of it, but in some ways, I think we're really just getting warmed up. You know, I've heard some people say that we're not just in early innings, it's batting practice, right? I think that we've seen a lot of strategic partnerships in the last year or two in particular, both between banks and private credit funds, but also between private credit funds in the forms of joint ventures and acquisitions. And I think we're going to see that persist as people get positioned to take advantage of what they think will be a robust deal environment.
So as you mentioned, the deal flow is expected to increase under the new administration, but could you talk more about also the implication of tariffs and how would that affect the deal environment?
It's a great question because I think right now all eyes are on China, Canada, and Mexico. Those are the three countries that the U.S. does most of its importing from. And with the caveat, right, and maybe I'll set a record in this podcast for caveats, with the caveat that there can always be a difference, right, or a delta between what an administration says they're going to do and then what actually comes to pass. I think here, you know, we have an explicit headline that there will likely be tariffs, significant ones, placed on those countries pretty quickly into the administration's term. What does that do to underwriting, right? What does that do to businesses and portfolio companies of private equity sponsors that otherwise have good, strong fundamentals, but that maybe rely on, you know, a specific chip that is only manufactured in a specific part of China, and that's the only place you can get it. And without it, you can't produce your product, right? Same thing with mold, same thing with a whole host of things. So you have the tariffs sort of competing with the other expectation of lower rates. Because if you think about, you know, drivers of inflation, cost of goods is clearly one of them. And so I think there's a big question mark around what that's going to mean for the banks and the markets generally, if rates, maybe the cuts don't come as quickly as people were anticipating, if the impact of the tariffs is, you know, half as bad as some people fear. That also creates opportunity too, though, for distressed or opportunistic investors. There will be potentially situations where, you know, short-term liquidity bridges are necessary. And I think there are a lot of players in the space that will be willing to step up to the plate. You also have to look at this right in the reverse. If we put a bunch of tariffs on these other countries, then the expectation and the stated goal or the stated result is going to be these countries putting tariffs on the U.S. And I think we saw some of this in the first Trump administration. That can disproportionately impact exporting of agricultural products, right, can become tough in that environment. And that could negatively impact, you know, farmers and agribusinesses. So it all kind of leads to a potential environment of, you know, what I'd consider macro volatility. where there may be, you know, not sort of a one-size-fits-all prediction of deal activity is going to go up. It's like, yeah, deal activity is likely going to go up, but there are going to be these other cross currents that the market has to deal with. The good news for private credit, history doesn't often repeat itself, but it almost always rhymes. And so we saw a lot of these cross currents during COVID when, you know, for different reasons, we still had massive impact to supply chain and massive impact to labor cost, which is another thing that I think when you think about some of the expected immigration reform, you know, what that's going to do to the cost of labor is something that people are focused on. That's another cross current. Private credit and private equity sponsors partnered really well during that period. And so I think people are, frankly, poised to build it better the second time around.
It's very interesting. I would like to ask you, since you mentioned farming and agriculture as a sector, what other sectors do you expect to be more active when it comes to M&A deals and private credit financings?
I think farming and agro might have a negative impact that it feels, you know, on tariffs being put in place in the U.S. But I think that there are a number of sectors and industries, right, where people are really excited about a potential uptick in activity. And again, with the caveat that I don't have a crystal ball and I'm not Nostradamus or even Nouriel Roubini, I guess, you know, they're all right twice a day. I do feel pretty confident in suggesting that oil and gas, I think that, you know, this administration is going to be really beneficial for energy exports. I think oil and drilling and the export of energy is going to really sort of take off and benefit from the new administration's policies. So if you do anything in that sector right now, you probably feel pretty good. And that could lead to more project finance and other types of financings. I think healthcare is one that we expect to benefit in terms of deal activity. I think there's been pressure and focus on some of the roll-up strategies the PE funds employ, particularly in the healthcare space. The expectation is that that will all be relaxed. You know, this should probably go without saying, but technology is certainly a sector where we would expect, look, you know, you look at the new FCC appointment, the outsized role of Elon Musk and Silicon Valley in the administration, right? And I think, you know, those folks are probably high-fiving about the deals that they're going to be able to get done. And then I think when you think about the M&A market and where there could be need and where there could be more flexibility, I also think I'd keep an eye on financial services and regional banks. I think for a long time, regional banks weren't able to merge. And you may start to see some of those partnerships take shape in a new administration with less regulation.
More distress in that sector, yeah. Actually. And now you could have more M&A. So this market has grown so fast. Are there enough deals to put all the dollars to work? Because there was some discussions that under the new administration, possibly 401k accounts would be allowed to invest in private credit. That would just contribute to a boom in the market. It's just speculation.
So look, challenge accepted. Give me every dollar and I will figure out a way to put it to work for my clients. Look, jokes aside, I think the answer to your question really hinges on how you define deals. I would make a distinction between direct lending and other types of transactions that private credit can take the lead on. So traditionally, right, direct lending was fueled by the LBO market, like acquisition financing. So if the question is, are there enough LBOs? Are there enough companies to buy and sell to, you know, deploy every dollar that's been raised in the space? I don't see how that's possible. And that's a great problem to have. I mentioned this at the outset. It's one of the things that I really love about the platform I'm on. We see such a wide spectrum and represent our clients through every phase of the life cycle that we're not concerned at all about not having enough LBO activity because, you know, look, and I'll take that with the 401k point too. Like if we get to a point where individuals can, if we can bring this product directly to, you know, the individual's table, I think you're just going to continue to see a wider variety of investment types. It's an outplayed analogy, but you got to think of private credit as like one giant toolbox of solutions for the global economy, quite frankly, but for businesses, large and small. And the solutions are made of capital. So direct lending, right, that's like the hammer. Like that may be the one that you think of most frequently. It's probably one of the most used, but there are so many other tools in that toolbox that private credit investors can avail themselves of, right? And so distressed and opportunistic investing is one, but we're seeing more and more movement towards private credit investing in the investment grade space. And if you think about it, that's a beautiful marriage for insurance capital and a product, right? Those, an investment grade investment and insurance capital go together really well because they meet sort of the mandates and requirements that the insurance pools need to comply with. Asset-based lending is something that I think everyone has heard a lot of funds talking about, but I think you'll see even more development in that space. And that's a really innovative area too, where a lot of structures are just sort of being invented and pioneered. And you see private credit now at the front of that. So I think, you know, and the other thing, look, the other thing is you could very well see bigger moves for private credit into real estate, into infrastructure, into project finance. This is just kind of what we're hearing today, but I think it's a particularly nimble asset class. So as things unfold, you know, I think I would expect private credit to be there with the money.
That's great. That's amazing. I want to shift now topics to deal structure. Unitranche deals have been the bread and butter of the business, but what other type of structures do you see currently as being more prevalent in the market?
So this is an interesting question because, you know, for the past couple of years, and I think this probably correlates to where we'd been with respect to interest rates, but we were actually seeing a lot of pref equity investments, and those can be done by private credit as well, calling back to your previous question. It'd be easy to sort of take the position or make the guess that, you know, as interest rates come down, you'll see less and less pref. And that may be true. But again, we don't know what's going to happen. And I do think there's been a lot of effort put into figuring out how to do a pref investment in the right way. So I don't really see that going anywhere. I think that'll still be, you know, yet another tool in the toolkit. We're also seeing along the same lines, I think there's been a lot more of loans at the holdco level and holdco pick loans. We've seen, frankly, in the past couple of years, more 1L, 2L structures than just unitranche. And those can be with banks or without. We've seen a lot more mezz. So I think I would sort of categorize it all as we've really seen, and I think we'll continue to see expansion into more hybrid-like structures and instruments in addition to the unitranche financings, which I don't think are going anywhere.
How often do you see investors taking the keys from private lenders?
So I think we see this more and more. And certainly in the last 1 to 2 years, we've seen it a lot. And you see it in more than one way, right? There's taking the keys, which I would think of as a consensual out-of-court restructuring that involves, you know, a secured lender or a group of secured lenders taking over the equity of the borrower. But then there's also like what we refer to as chucking the keys, where the private equity sponsor is just like, look, I don't have any additional equity to put into this for whatever reason. Maybe it's the end of the vintage of the fund, or they've just decided it's time to crystallize the loss, you know, whatever the decision is. You'll see sometimes sponsors saying like, I will just give you the key. Just take it. Like, this is your problem now. And that happens too. And I think a lot of it is driven by people sort of waking up to the fact that bankruptcy is expensive and it can take time. And there are good reasons for that. And there are reasons why sometimes that has to be the forum. But I think that there's now a push to sort of figure out if there's a way. Everyone's just looking to maximize their investment. I think with this stuff, everyone's, you know, heart is in the right place. They just want to maximize value for their stakeholders. And sometimes the way to do that is to do it out of court.
Can you go a little bit deeply into some pros and cons of like going through a Chapter 11 and it's more expensive, we know, or just trying to just take the keys quietly and don't try to?
So look, I think high level, if you can do a restructuring out of court, that can be cheaper and that can be faster. You don't have the same professional fee burn. You don't have the ability to drag out the process. It's typically consensual. And importantly, there's less of a PR hit to the business, and that can preserve value. Not filing for bankruptcy can avoid a whole host of PR concerns, because if you're out of court, you can always sort of massage and control the messaging. Now, that said, some liabilities simply cannot be addressed outside of bankruptcy on a non-consensual basis, and that could be anything from, you know, misalignment among lenders and the basis, you know, the cost basis at which they bought into the loan to, you know,
pension benefits and other like
exactly all sorts of employee benefits, exactly real estate, right? Dealing with leases, landlords. So it really is a case by case determination. because bankruptcy, you know, is at least a forum where you can resolve all disputes. If there is any misalignment among various stakeholders, that could be dealt with. And there's a sort of, we talk about this in the context of the front end, but I think it's true of bankruptcy court as well. There's like a certainty of execution. Whereas if you're doing something out of court, you know, at any point in time, it could take a turn, it could fall apart. So it really is, I know it's not the most satisfying answer. I wish I could tell you like, this is the one size fits all thing that's better, but it really is case by case.
I mean, Pluralsight, what happened there really changed kind of the dynamics in the market, do you think? Do you see?
I cannot tell you how much I love talking about this. So Pluralsight, I love talking about for so many reasons. I think, yes, I think it did change the dynamics, although I would question in some ways why it did. So basically, the sponsor there moved some IP to a foreign subsidiary because notably there was J.Crew blocking language in the credit agreement that would have precluded material IP from being moved to an unrestricted subsidiary. Let me caveat again, I'm definitely winning an award for caveats. We didn't work on Pluralsight. I don't have firsthand knowledge. This is just what we as a market understand the docs to have permitted. This is not a firsthand account of what they say. So based on our understanding, IP was moved to a foreign subsidiary. That foreign subsidiary then issued pref, which was dividended to the borrower, the proceeds of which were dividended to the borrower. That was used to refresh the basket and the money went, you know, up and out. I think that Pluralsight got a ton of attention because people were saying, oh, this is the first liability management transaction that's been done in private credit. But for many of us who work in private credit day in, day out, that reaction was sort of puzzling because I would argue that we've been doing liability management transactions of one form or another. Oftentimes it's just a threat. It's just a stick that you use to get people on board for an amendment. But this is not exactly some novel concept, right? That assets might be moved away or that there may be some sort of coercion involved in getting an amendment signed up.
They happen all the time in the BSL market.
Yes. But I think that this one was public. It was actually the sponsor driving the transaction, which is kind of funny when you think about it, right? Because everyone in the market, and I get this, right? I get why there's, you know, this like tendency to talk about liability management transactions in these very, you know, extreme terms, like lender on lender violence. Well, this wasn't lender on lender violence, right? This was the sponsor doing the transaction. The lenders weren't involved at all. And in fact, I think a number were not thrilled with the way it turned out. And so I do think it got everyone's attention. I do think that for those people who were saying private credit is going to be somehow immune from liability management, I think it got their attention. But I think the unsung sort of story of Pluralsight that I would urge anyone listening to this to focus on, it's always in my mind the things that are, when you look at them, like the most obvious, but just not what you were expecting, that I think are the most fascinating slash frightening slash places where there's work to do, places where I feel I can add value. Here, the fact that this was effectuated by an issuance of pref as opposed to a debt instrument, I think is really important because notably, it is our understanding that there was not enough debt capacity to do the transaction. And that's why it was done in the form of pref. And what I think a listener should take away is when you look at any sort of loan agreement or financial contract, and you are looking at a defined term, capital I indebtedness, well, now every time you see that, you should be thinking in your head, that does not cover pref. So anything that says, I can't do this kind of debt, I can't incur that kind of debt, realistically, it probably doesn't cover pref. Now, do I think that this is something that should shock the market and change things? No. In fact, I don't think that it would make sense. And I don't think we necessarily are going to see changes to the debt definition starting to clear market. That would be shocking. And I don't necessarily think even appropriate. But when you want to be eyes wide open about what your risk profile looks like and what could happen or what you may want to take advantage of, right? What you may want to look to use as a lever if you're trying to figure out a way to provide a capital solution to a business. I think the thing to take away from Pluralsight in part is, oh, wait, you could do a lot of this with equity. And look, you may not have a business that wants to give away pref. And again, all the stuff about where we are with rates and here, the fact that it was the sponsor probably made them a suitable entity to issue the pref to. They probably have more appetite for it. But just know that that's on the table.
It's very interesting. And we're also talking about how sponsors, you know, that are initiating this type of transactions or that are more aggressive, they could be blacklisted. But it doesn't really happen in real life, right? It's just whenever a transaction happens, everybody has high spirits, everybody's angry, and then time passes and it's almost like the money's there and needs to be put to work.
I'm a little skeptical. Maybe I've been doing this for too long. I think anytime I totally understand the human reaction in the moment where an investment is being treated in a way that you didn't anticipate and that, you know, is not the outcome that you planned for or were hoping for, that makes all the sense in the world. And some of these transactions are extremely aggressive. So I'm not trying to understate that at all. But this idea, anytime someone makes some broad statement of like, oh, well, that sponsor is going to be blacklisted. Well, okay. I mean, it's kind of like basic economic theory of supply and demand, right? I think there's a lot of money that needs to be put to work. Going back to one of your earlier questions, like, are there enough deals to get done? Probably not. There's a lot of dry powder and a lot of patient capital that's ready to get to work. So I think that the odds of a sponsor being blacklisted, that's certainly not something that I'm preparing for. And I think that when you look at the LMEs that get done, it's, you know, you want to kind of sharpshoot around a small handful of participants, but that's actually not the case. I think that, you know, oftentimes it's a company needing money or runway and then a number of constituents agreeing on a path to get that capital injected into the business. I think there's enough money in the system that I'd be skeptical of anyone being blacklisted.
Talking about LMEs, you look at docs every day, and I'm curious, what protections are private borrowers asking for nowadays, post-Pluralsight?
You know, kind of piggybacking on what we were just talking about, I think it's important to acknowledge as part of the answer to your question that the sponsors and lenders have worked together on a lot of these liability management transactions, and they've also really worked together on refining the provisions in the documents to address and provide protection, right? I think there's always like this, like we were saying, this temptation to go for these splashy headlines with, you know, sort of dramatic language and you know, pearl clutching around violence. But, you know, the irony in my mind is that documents today, I would say, have much greater minority lender protections than they did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago. And that doesn't happen without the sponsors and the borrowers agreeing to some concessions. So sort of like a quick list of what I think, you know, you often see parties rationally agreeing to some form of protection around. I think it's pretty common now that there's going to be J.Crew protection. Now, interestingly, in the wake of Pluralsight, I think J.Crew protection is now more limited. Like sometimes you raise the points and you almost wonder if on the lender side we're kind of making the documents worse in a way, because you used to be able to argue, you know, that your J.Crew blocker that would stop material IP or whatever the crown jewel asset that you identify, but usually it's IP, you would agree that that won't be transferred to an unrestricted subsidiary. And, you know, you negotiate in the margins around what the transfer means and if they could have it or generate it on their own and all those things. But by and large, right, you can't move material IP to an unrestricted subsidiary. And then you could argue at the time, well, but that should also pick up, you know, non-loan party restricted subsidiaries, right, i.e. foreign subsidiaries. But now that we're sort of drawing this distinction and saying we want Pluralsight protection, now, right, and you don't always get that. So now Pluralsight protection is, you know, largely, I think, thought to mean that your J.Crew blocker will also extend to those non-loan party foreign subsidiaries, but with different carve-outs and different qualifications. And that's my point around, are we making this worse? Right now, you have sort of two sets of provisions that you're looking at. But I think, you know, you can expect J.Crew, Pluralsight. I think the market hasn't quite coalesced and we're seeing that go both ways. I think that, you know, getting protection around a PetSmart Chewy type transaction is fairly common. And I think on the up tier exchange points or the, you know, amendments to pro rata sharing provisions, like what I like to think of as like CERTA, NYDJ, Trimark, Board Riders, right, whatever you want to call it, I think those are quite common to get. I think that they typically come with exceptions. Most notably, I think the market has largely coalesced around the idea that if you offer the transaction to everybody, well, then you don't need every lender's consent, because, you know, arguably you shouldn't have one small lender that, you know, bought in perhaps recently with a tremendous amount of holdup value, right? If you get the opportunity to participate in the new money solution, then your vote shouldn't be needed beyond simple majority. I think people have kind of wrapped their heads around that. And that's not how documents looked 10 years ago, right? The protections in large part didn't even necessarily exist. So we're still sort of arguing around some of the contours, like do you carve out dip financings? We see that a lot, right? From the up tier exchange protections, things like that. I think we're still light years ahead of where we were. And people are asking for more protections and getting, you know, like I said, Pluralsight. The other thing you see now is some people asking for protections against at home, right? Protections against like a double dip transaction. And I think, you know, those are less common, but it's just a far cry. I think when the liability management transactions first started happening, and I'll admit, I felt this way too, right? You can feel overwhelmed and you look at the documents and it's almost like, gosh, is this just whack-a-mole, right? Like, is there any way to plug every hole in the dam? And the answer is no, probably not. But that doesn't mean you don't try, especially because the sponsors are willing to meet you halfway. So I think the partnerships there have actually been pretty strong. I know I sound a little bit Pollyanna-ish on this, but I genuinely believe that if you look at the entire body of work, particularly in the private credit market, but you know, in BSL as well, I do think, you know, better to not make perfect the enemy of good and, you know, try to find that balance.
I mean, you talk about the sponsors and LMEs, what type of lax terms do you think borrowers in the space and the sponsors backing them are trying to squeeze into documents? Because there was talk about high water marking EBITDA and even preventing lenders from executing LMEs in the future.
The list goes on and on. Now I'll talk out of the other side of my mouth where I'm like, yeah, maybe it is whack-a-mole. I'm just kidding. I think, yes, what are the terms? And also importantly, it's not just what, it's where. Where are they starting to stick these terms? So this is my PSA for anyone that might be listening to this podcast. That section right after the definitions, it's like the principles of construction. It's usually like section 1.2, say. Read that. Read all of it, because that's where we're starting to see some of these provisions that are really meaningful and have a huge ripple effect around the entire document. That's where they're being inserted. So, for example, you mentioned EBITDA high watermarking, and that's basically a provision that says that whatever your highest EBITDA was, you just get to keep that forever for purposes of all of your incurrence tests, right, in your baskets. And so we'll see that sometimes put, you know, in that section of the document. I think another thing that we're seeing—
But lenders are fighting, right? You're not really— Lenders
are certainly pushing back on that, but there are deals where it makes it through. And look, that's a material change to the way you think about the flexibility that the borrower could have throughout the life of the deal. You know, another thing you used to see sort of pick your poison provisions, right, which would allow you to convert RPs and RDPs to debt capacity and things like that. Now it's like pick your anything, I would say, where you can just basically reallocate. You know, investments were always kind of carved out of the pick your poison provisions, but now you could, you know, there are some deals where the ask is to be able to take investment capacity and convert that into RP capacity or convert all of that into extra debt capacity. And then relatedly, we're really starting to see your incremental section, the fixed starter provision, is now starting to pick up your general debt basket. And if you think about the numbers associated with those baskets, that's a meaningful uptick in your day one capacity for additional, you know, pari passu debt potentially. So look, that's a tremendous amount of debt capacity. I think it's important to take a second though and also talk about what we're seeing, not just in the performing sort of, you know, new issue market, but when I think about our more distressed investors and opportunistic investors, or just anyone that's been through a bankruptcy, we're definitely starting to see a proliferation of in sort of dips and exits and sort of rescue financings, anything with a little more hair on it. We're starting to see sweeping provisions that purport to foreclose any potential liability management transaction in the future. You know, I think about the exit financing, for example, for Spirit Airlines. That is a deal that Paul Hastings did work on. We represented an ad hoc group there, and this is all publicly filed. But, you know, my partners, Matt Warren and James Gallagher and Lindsay Hendrickson, were able to get language in the exit financing that, I'm really simplifying this, but it basically says that you can't do any LME unless you offer it to everybody. Similar to, right, that up-tiering, you know, CERTA, NYDJ language we were just talking about. If you offer it to everyone, then there's still deals that can get done. And so, you know, that's just, I think, the latest attempt I can think of around, you know, wanting to again, find that balance of pre-baking in protections, but also providing some flexibility for a rainy day.
That's very interesting because I don't think we've seen that. I think this could be a first for Spirit Airlines, right? Because it's embedded in the dip agreement and then it's going to be transferred to the exit.
Yeah, well, I think it's in the exit. There are other deals certainly in the market that have, you know, sort of these anti-LME provisions. But this one, I think, is particularly notable because it has that offer to all exception.
Pro-rata, right?
That provides this flexibility for a potential future LME, but really does protect the lenders.
Great. I guess we have to wrap it up. And I want to ask you, last question would be, what is your outlook, long-term outlook for the private credit sector? Since we spoke about the next, few months, a year under Trump.
This may come as no surprise, but I am extremely bullish on the private credit space. I think, you know, I mentioned earlier that I think this administration will bring with it a certain level of macro volatility with these various cross currents, and we don't know how everything is going to work out. But if past is prologue, and I really think, you know, it is when it comes to private credit, we are built for this. We are built for exactly this. Like, if you think about when private credit really started to take root, it was during the Great Financial Crisis. And then when you think about when, you know, it actually kind of experienced this further explosion, it's kind of during COVID. Like, this is an asset class that is built for macro volatility. I genuinely think that with the proliferation of different structures and different types of products that it's creeping into, there's all sorts of opportunity. When you think about the new asset classes and the structures, that's what gets me excited about working in the space, because I think we are surrounded here by, I can't state this strongly enough, breathtakingly talented investors. Like, our clients are so smart. And with the benefit of having been through a lot of this stuff with, in terms of supply chain pressures, for example, I think that it's not really even, they're poised not to take on the next 4 years, but the next 10.
Bring it on.
Let's go.
Let's go. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Jennifer, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thanks for taking the time to share your valuable insights. And thank you to you, our listeners, for checking out this episode of That Wired. As always, you can subscribe or download every episode via Apple and find thousands of articles with insights, research, and more from our team at thatwired.com. See you next time.